intake from whole foods, namely tomatoes. So while these studies certainly indicate that the tomato is a healthy food, does that mean we can assume that lycopene, by itself, reduces prostate cancer risk? There are hundreds, even thousands of chemicals in tomatoes. Do we have evidence that a lycopene pill will do what tomatoes do, especially for those who don't like tomatoes? The answer is no. Nonetheless, the lycopene business is up and running. In-depth studies are underway to determine the most effective dose of lycopene and whether commercial lycopene preparations are safe, when tested in rats and rabbits, that is. Also, the industry is considering genetically modifying plants for higher levels of lycopene and other carotenoids. It is a real stretch to call this series of lycopene reports legitimate science. In my book, this is what I call technological tinkering and marketing, not science. 5 years before the latest discovery of lycopene, a graduate student of mine, Yuping He, compared four different carotenoids, beta-carotene, lycopene from tomatoes, canthaxanthin from carrots, and cryptoxanthin from oranges, for their ability to prevent cancer in experimental animals. Depending on what we were testing and how we did the test, single carotenoids could have widely ranging potencies. While one carotenoid is potent in one reaction, the same carotenoid is far less potent in another. This variation manifests itself in countless ways involving hundreds of antioxidants and thousands of different reactions, forming a nearly indecipherable network. Consuming one carotenoid at a time in the form of a pill will never be the same as eating the whole food, which provides the natural network of health-supporting nutrients. And in fact, the most recent research on lycopene has borne this out. According to a May 2016 review of the lycopene research literature, as part of a review of the use of phytochemicals to prevent cancer, there is no convincing evidence that lycopene, in supplemental form, has any significant benefit over just eating a tomato. Indeed, high doses of lycopene were associated with a higher incidence of prostate cancer, and readers were warned that the use of these supplements should be avoided. Fruit claims. The fruit industry plays this game just like everyone else. For example, when you think of vitamin C, what food product comes to mind? If you don't think of oranges and orange juice, you are unusual. Most of us have heard ad nauseum that oranges are a good source of vitamin C. This belief, however, is just another result of good marketing. How much do you know, for example, about vitamin C's relationship to diet and disease? Let's start with the basics. Although you probably know that oranges are a good source of vitamin C, you may be surprised to know that many other plant foods have considerably more. One cup of peppers, strawberries, broccoli, or peas all have more. One papaya has as much as four times more vitamin C than one orange. Beyond the fact that many other foods are better sources of vitamin C, what can we say about the vitamin C that is in oranges? This concerns the ability of the vitamin to act as an antioxidant. How much of the total antioxidant activity in an orange is actually contributed by its vitamin C? Probably not more than 1 to 2%. Furthermore, measuring antioxidant activity by using test tube studies does not represent the same vitamin C activity that takes place in our bodies. Most of our impressions about vitamin C and oranges are a mixture of conjectures and assumptions about out-of-context evidence. Who first established these assumptions? Orange merchants. Did they justify their assumptions on the basis of careful research? Of course not. Did these assumptions, presented as fact, sound good to the marketing people? Of course they did. Would I eat an orange to get my vitamin C? No. Would I eat an orange because it is a healthy plant food with a complex network of chemicals that almost certainly offer health benefits? Absolutely. I played a small role in this story a couple of decades ago. In the 1970s and 1980s, I appeared in a television ad for citrus fruits. a New York public relations firm for the Florida Citrus Commission, had earlier interviewed me about fruit, nutrition, and health. This interview, unknown to me at the time, was the source of my presence in the ad. I had not seen the ad, and I did not get paid for it, but nonetheless, I was one of the talking heads that helped the Florida Citrus Commission build its case for the vitamin C content of oranges. Why did I do the interview? At that point in my career, I probably thought that the vitamin C in oranges was important, and regardless of vitamin C, oranges were very healthy foods to eat. It is very easy for scientists to get caught in the reductionism web of thinking, even if they have other intentions. Not until recently, after a lifetime of research, did I come to realize how damaging it is to take details out of context and to make subsequent claims about diet and health. Industry uses these details extremely well, and the result is public confusion. Every year, it seems, some new product is being touted as the key to good health. The situation is so bad that health sections of grocery stores are often stocked more with supplements and special preparations of seemingly magic ingredients than they are with real food. Don't be tricked. The healthiest section of any store is the place where they sell whole fruits and vegetables, the produce section. Perhaps worst of all, industry corrupts scientific evidence, even when its product has been linked to serious health problems. Our kids are often the most coveted targets of their marketing. The American government has passed legislation preventing cigarette and alcohol companies from marketing their products to children. Why have we ignored food? Even though it is accepted that food plays a major role in many chronic diseases, we allow food industries not only to market directly to children, but also to use our publicly funded school systems to do it. The long-term burden of our short-sighted indiscretion is incalculable. The misuse of science continues unabated. As I return to the topic of science's relationship with industry for this second edition 10 years later, I do not believe it is necessary to regale you with still more stories like those told here, although there is no shortage of them. The biggest question is not why there are so many of these stories, but why these stories are such a surprise to so many people. Industry has a mandate, first and foremost, to meet the needs of its investors. Almost every industry leader is beholden to their shareholders to make a profitable business. If they fail to reach expectations, there are others ready and willing to take their place. This is Business 101. But when it comes to the business of health products and their marketing, what sells can't be the most important driver. Accuracy and reliability of industry food health claims is. Industry leaders and their scientists should be ready to answer vital questions about the health benefits of the products they tout. Should side effects be required alongside benefit claims? How serious must a side effect be for it to be listed on a label alongside a health claim? Should the chances of experiencing the side effect be stated? When the chances of a chemical causing cancer are less than 1 in 1,000,000, for example, we do not have to label it as a carcinogen. It's difficult, if not impossible, to give definitive answers to these questions. Yet the public tends to want reasonably definite answers, and so marketing offers them, even when they shouldn't. There is financial pressure to push health claims to their limits, to use science to sell, and as a result, we have a contest between the marketing manager, who is driven to sell, and the scientist, who must be mindful of their reputation. As a scientist, I know this tension all too well, especially from my time as a witness in Federal Trade Commission hearings. The science of the marketing manager is seldom my science. Chapter 16. Government. Is it for the people? During the past 2 to 3 decades, we have acquired substantial evidence that most chronic diseases in America can be partially attributed to bad nutrition. Expert government panels have said it, the Surgeon General has said it, and academic scientists have said it. More people die because of the way they eat than from tobacco use, accidents, or any other lifestyle or environmental factor. We know that the incidence of obesity and diabetes is skyrocketing, and that Americans' health is slipping away. And we know what to blame. Diet. So, shouldn't the government be leading us to better nutrition? The government can take no greater action to prevent pain and suffering in this country than to tell Americans unequivocally to eat fewer animal products, fewer highly refined plant products, and more whole plant-based foods. It is a message soundly based on the breadth and depth of scientific evidence, and the government could make this clear, as it did with cigarettes. Cigarettes kill, and so do these bad foods. But instead of doing this, the government is saying that animal products, dairy and meat, refined sugar and fat in your diet are good for you. The government is turning a blind eye to the evidence as well as to the millions of Americans who suffer from nutrition-related illnesses. The covenant of trust between the U.S. government and the American citizen has been broken. It is not only failing to put out our fires, it is actively fanning the flames. Dietary ranges, the latest assault. The Food and Nutrition Board, FNB, as part of the Institute of Medicine, IOM, of the National Academy of Sciences, has the responsibility, every 5 years or so, to review and update the recommended consumption of individual nutrients. The FNB has been making nutrient recommendations since 1943, when it established a plan for the U.S. Armed Forces that included recommended daily allowances, RDAs, for each individual nutrient. In the 2002 FNB report, nutrient recommendations were presented as ranges instead of single numbers, as had been the practice. For good health, we are now advised to consume from 45% to 65% of our calories as carbohydrates. There are ranges for fat and protein as well. A few quotes from the news release announcing this massive 900-plus page report say it all. Here is the first sentence. To meet the body's daily energy and nutritional needs while minimizing risk for chronic disease, adults should get 45 to 65% of their calories from carbohydrates, 20 to 35% from fat, and 10 to 35% from protein. Further, we find, added sugars should comprise no more than 25% of total calories consumed. Added sugars are those incorporated into foods and beverages during production, and major sources include candy, soft drinks, fruit drinks, pastries, and other sweets. Let's take a closer look. What are these recommendations really saying? Remember, the news release starts off by stating the report's objective of minimizing risk for chronic disease. This report says that we can consume a diet containing up to 35% of calories as fat. This is up from the 30% limit of previous reports. It also recommends that we can consume up to 35% of calories as protein. This number is far higher than the suggestion of any other responsible authority. The last recommendation puts the frosting on the cake, so to speak. We can consume up to 25% of calories as added sugars. Remember, sugars are the most refined type of carbohydrates. In effect, although the report advises that we need a minimum of 45% of calories as carbohydrates, more than half of this amount, that is 25%, can be the sugars present in candies, soft drinks, and pastries. The critical assumption of this report is this. The American diet is not only the best there is, but you should now feel free to eat an even richer diet and still be confident that you are minimizing risk for chronic disease. Forget any words of caution you may find in this report. With such a range of possibilities, virtually any diet can be advocated as minimizing disease risk. You may have trouble getting your mind around what these figures mean in everyday terms. So I have prepared the following menu plan that supplies nutrients in accordance with these guidelines. Chart 16.1. Chart 16.1. Sample menu that fits into the acceptable nutrient ranges. Meal, breakfast. Foods, 1 cup Fruit Loops, 1 cup skim milk, 1 package M&M milk chocolate candies, fiber and vitamin supplements. Meal, lunch. Foods, grilled cheddar cheeseburger. Meal, dinner. Foods, 3 slices pepperoni pizza, 1 16-ounce soda, 1 serving Archway sugar cookies. Folks, I'm not kidding. This disastrous menu plan fits the recommendations of the report and is supposedly consistent with minimizing chronic disease. What's amazing is that I could put together a variety of menus, all drenched in animal foods and added sugars, that conform to these recommended daily allowances. At this point in the book, I don't need to tell you that when we eat a diet like this, day in and day out, we will be not just marching, but sprinting into the arms of chronic disease. In sad fact, this is what a large proportion of our population already does. Protein. Perhaps the most shocking figure is the upper limit on protein intake. Relative to total calorie intake, only 5 to 6% dietary protein is required to replace the protein regularly excreted by the body as amino acids. About 9 to 10% protein, however, is the amount that has been recommended for the past 50 years to be assured that most people at least get their 5 to 6% requirement. This 9 to 10% recommendation is equivalent to the well-known RDA. Almost all Americans exceed this 9 to 10% recommendation. We consume protein within the range of about 11 to 21%, with an average of about 15 to 16%. The relatively few people consuming more than 21% protein mostly are those who pump iron, joined by those on high-protein diets. It is extremely puzzling that these government-sponsored 2002 FNB recommendations now say that we should be able to consume protein up to the extraordinary level of 35% as a means of minimizing chronic illnesses like cancer and heart disease. This is an unbelievable travesty, considering the scientific evidence. The evidence presented in this book shows that increasing dietary protein within the range of about 10 to 20% is associated with a broad array of health problems, especially when most of the protein is from animal sources. As reviewed earlier in this book, diets with more animal-based protein will create higher blood cholesterol levels and higher risk of atherosclerosis, cancer, osteoporosis, Alzheimer's disease, and kidney stones, to name just a few chronic diseases that the FNB committee mysteriously chose to ignore. Furthermore, the FNB panel had the audacity to say that this 10 to 35% recommendation range is the same as previous reports. Their press release clearly states, "Protein intake recommendations are the same as previous reports." I know of no report that has even remotely suggested a level as high as this. When I initially saw this protein recommendation, I honestly thought it was a printing error. But no, it was correct. I know several of the people on the panel who wrote this report and decided to give them a ring. The first panel member, a longtime acquaintance, said this was the first time he had even heard about the 35% protein limit. He suggested that this protein recommendation might have been drafted in the last days of preparing the report. He also told me that there was little discussion of the evidence on protein, for or against a high consumption level, although he recollected there being some pro-Atkins sympathy on the committee. He had not worked in the protein area, so he did not know the literature. In any event, this important recommendation slipped through the panel without much notice and made the first sentence of the FNB news release. The second panel member, a longtime friend and colleague, was a subcommittee chair during the latter part of the panel's existence. He is not a nutritional scientist, and also was surprised to hear my concerns about the upper limit for protein. He did not recall much discussion on the topic either. When I reminded him of some of the evidence linking diets high in animal protein to chronic disease, he initially was somewhat defensive. but with a little more persistence on my part about the evidence, he finally said, "Colin, you know that I really don't know anything about nutrition." How then was he a member, let alone the chair, of this important subcommittee? And it gets worse. The chair of the Standing Committee on the Evaluation of these Recommendations left the panel shortly before its completion for a senior executive position in a very large food company, a company that will salivate over these new recommendations. A sugar-coated report. The recommendation on added sugar is as outrageous as the one for protein. At about the time this FNB report was being released, an expert panel put together by the WHO, World Health Organization, and the FAO, Food and Agriculture Organization, was completing a new report on diet, nutrition, and preventing chronic diseases. Professor Philip James, another friend of mine, was a member of this panel and a panel spokesperson on the added sugar recommendation. Early rumors of the report's findings indicated that the WHO-FAO was on the verge of recommending an upper safe limit of 10% for added sugar, far lower than the 25% established by the American FNB group. Politics, however, had entered the discussion early, as it had done in earlier reports on added sugars. According to a news release from the Director General's office at the WHO, the U.S.-based Sugar Association, and the World Sugar Research Organization, who represent the interests of the sugar growers and refiners, had mounted a strong lobbying campaign in an attempt to discredit the WHO report and suppress its release. They did not like setting the upper safe limit so low. According to the Guardian newspaper of London, the U.S. sugar industry was threatening to bring the World Health Organization to its knees unless it abandoned these guidelines on added sugar. WHO people were describing the threat as tantamount to blackmail and worse than any pressure exerted by the tobacco industry. The U.S.-based group even publicly threatened to lobby the U.S. Congress to reduce the $406 million U.S. funding of the WHO if it persisted in keeping the upper limit so low at 10%. There were reports, after a letter was sent by the industry to Secretary of Health and Human Services Tommy Thompson, that the Bush administration was inclined to side with the sugar industry. I and many other scientists were being encouraged at that time to contact our congressional representatives to stop this outrageous, strong-armed tactic by the U.S. sugar companies. So, for added sugars, we now have two different upper safe limits: a 10% limit for the international community, and a 25% limit for the U.S. Why such a huge difference? Did the sugar industry succeed in controlling the U.S.-based FNB report, but fail with the WHO-FAO report? What does this say about the FNB scientists who also devised the new protein recommendation? These wildly different estimates are not a matter of scientific interpretation. This is nothing more than naked political muscle. Professor James and his colleagues at the WHO stood up to the pressure. The FNB group appears to have caved in. The U.S. panel received funding from the M&M Mars Candy Company and a consortium of soft drink companies. Is it possible that the U.S. group felt an obligation to these sugar companies? Incidentally, the sugar industry, in their fight against the WHO conclusion, has relied heavily on the FNB report with its 25% limit. In other words, the FNB committee produces a friendly recommendation for the sugar industry, which then turns around and uses this finding to support its claim against the WHO report. It's true that when government leaders need advice on policy development, they often turn to expert panels, most composed of academics. But having served on several of these panels, it is clear to me that the government leaders responsible for funding these panels exercise considerable control over their recommendations. Aside from providing the funding, they write the panel's remits and are generally active in choosing each panel's chair. The chair, whose views on the topic are often, though not always, known to be acceptable to the government agency, often helps to select the remaining members. Because of this, these panels do not often stray too far from government interests. Keep in mind also that panel recommendations are almost always, in my experience, advisory only, meaning that the government staff can select what they like from the report. There are several ways that government and industry can work for a common purpose, but from my first-hand experience, I believe that this linkage is one of the subtlest but nonetheless most powerful collaborations. A policy that flows from such bodies can be far-reaching. The influence of industry. This discussion still leaves unanswered the question of how industry develops such extraordinary influence. Industry mostly develops consultancies with a few publicly visible figures in academia, who then take leadership in policy positions outside of academia. However, these industry consultants continue to wear their academic hats. They organize symposia and workshops, write commissioned reviews, chair expert policy groups, and/or become officers of key professional societies. They gravitate toward the leadership positions in science-based organizations that develop significant policy and publicity. Once in these positions, these people then have the opportunity to assemble teams to their liking by choosing committee members, symposia speakers, management staff, and so forth. The kinds of people most helpful to the team are either colleagues with similar prejudices and/or colleagues who are oblivious to who is calling the shots. It's called stacking the deck, and it really works. In the case of the FNB, its panel was organized while being chaired by an academic with strong personal ties with the dairy industry. He helped in selecting the right people and setting the agenda for the report, the most significant roles that anyone could have played. Is it surprising that the dairy industry, which must have been ecstatic with the panel's findings, also helped to finance the report? You might be surprised to learn that academic scientists can receive personal compensation from industry while simultaneously undertaking government-sponsored activities of considerable public importance. Ironically, they can even help set the agenda for the same government authorities who have long been restricted from such corporate associations. It is a huge conflict of interest loophole that allows industries to exercise their influence through the side door of academia. In effect, the entire system is essentially under the control of industry. The government and academic communities, playing their respective roles, mostly do as they are expected to do. In addition to the M&M Mars Company, the corporate sponsors of the FNB report also included major food and drug companies that would benefit from higher protein and sugar allowances. The Danon Institute, a leading dairy industry consortium promoting its own brand of nutrition information, and the International Life Sciences Institute, ILSI, a front group for about 50 food, supplement, and drug companies, both contributed funding for the FNB report. Corporate members include Coca-Cola, Taco Bell, Burger King, Nestle, Pfizer, and Roche Vitamins. Some drug companies sponsored the report directly, in addition to their support through ILSI. I don't recall private corporations providing financial support for the NAS expert panels that I served on. It seems as if there is no end to this story. The chair of the FNB has been an important consultant to several major dairy-related companies. For example, National Dairy Council, Mead Johnson Nutritionals, a major seller of dairy-based products, Nestle Company, and a Danon yogurt affiliate. While chairing FNB, he was also chair of the Dietary Guidelines Committee, which establishes the food guide pyramid and sets national nutrition policy, affecting the National School Lunch and Breakfast Programs, the Food Stamp Program, and the Women, Infants, and Children, WIC, Supplemental Feeding Program. As chair of this latter committee, His personal financial associations with the food industry were not publicly revealed, as required by federal law. Eventually, a court order initiated by the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine was required to force him and his fellow colleagues to reveal their relationships with the food industry. Although the chair's industry associations were more substantial, 6 of the 11 committee members also were shown to have ties to the dairy industry. The entire system of developing public nutrition information, as I originally saw with the Public Nutrition Information Committee that I once chaired, see Chapter 13, has been invaded and co-opted by industry sources that have the interest and resources to do so. They run the show. They buy a few academic hacks who have gained positions of power and to exercise considerable influence, both within academia and government. It seems curious that while government scientists are not allowed to receive personal compensation from the private sector, their colleagues in academia can receive all that they can get. In turn, these conflicted individuals then run the show in collaboration with their government counterparts. However, restricting academics from receiving corporate consultancies is not the answer. That would only drive it underground. Rather, the situation would be best handled by making one's industry connections a matter of public disclosure. Everyone needs to know the full extent of each academic's associations with the private sector. Disclosure and full transparency is in everyone's interest. These associations should not be something we have to go to court to discover. Setting us back for years. Lest you think that this Food and Nutrition Board report is merely a 5-second news bite that then gets filed into a dusty old cabinet somewhere in Washington, let me assure you that this panel's findings directly affect tens of millions of people. According to the summary of the report itself, the recommended levels of nutrient consumption that are set by this panel are the basis for nutrition labeling of foods for the Food Guide Pyramid and for other nutrition education programs. They are used to determine the types and amounts of food provided in the WIC, Supplemental Feeding Program, and the child nutrition programs such as school lunch, served in hospitals, and nursing homes for Medicare reimbursement. Found in the food supply that should be fortified with specific nutrients. Used in a host of other important federal and state programs and activities, such as establishing reference values used in food labeling. The school lunch program fed 29.5 million children every day in May 2015. With officially recommended consumption patterns like these, we are at liberty to put any agricultural commodity we want into the hungry mouths of children already suffering from unprecedented levels of obesity and diabetes. By the way, the 2002 FNB report does make one special exception for children. It says that they can consume up to 40% of calories as fat, up from 35% for the rest of us, while minimizing the risk of chronic disease. The WIC program affects the diets of another 8.3 million Americans, and the Medicare hospital programs feed millions of people every year. It is safe to say that the food provided by these government programs directly feeds at least 39 million Americans a month. For people who are not directly fed by the government, this nutrient information still has significant consequences. From September 2002 onwards, nutrition education programs around the country have incorporated these new guidelines. This includes education in primary schools, universities, health professional programs, and other community-based programs. Food labels also will be affected by these changes, as will the nutrition information that seeps into our lives via advertising. Almost all of the wide-ranging effects of this 2002 FNB report will be profoundly harmful. In school, our children can be fed more fat, more meat, more milk, more animal protein, and more sugar. They will also learn that this food is consistent with good health. The ramifications of this are serious, as a whole generation will walk the path of obesity, diabetes, and other chronic illnesses, all the while believing that they are doing the right thing. Meanwhile, our government and its academic hacks can feel free to unload more meat, more fat, more animal protein, and more sugar onto the neediest among us. For example, WIC participants. I consider this to be an irresponsible and callous disregard for American citizens. Of course, these women and infants are not in a position to pay for research, donate to politicians, give academics special favors, or fund government panels. For others concerned about nutrition, every time they see a dietitian, every time they see their doctor, every time they see a nutritionist, and every time they go to a community health center, they may be told that a diet high in fat, animal protein, meat, and dairy is consistent with good health, and they needn't worry about eating too many sweets. Posters that deck the bulletin boards of public institutions will now feature these new government guidelines as well. In short, this 2002 FNB report, which represents the most sweeping, regressive nutrition policy statement I have ever seen, will either indirectly or directly promote sickness among Americans for many years to come. Having been a member of several diet and health policy-making expert panels over a 20-year period, I harbored the view that these panels were dedicated to the promotion of consumer health. I no longer believe this to be true. Unfunded nutrition. Not only is the government failing to promote health through its recommendations and reports, it is squandering an opportunity to promote public health through scientific research. The U.S. National Institutes of Health, NIH, is responsible for funding at least 80 to 90% of all biomedical and nutrition-related research that is published in the scientific literature. To address a range of health topics, the NIH comprises 27 separate institutes and centers, including its two largest, the National Cancer Institute, NCI, and the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. With a 2015 budget of $30.55 billion, the NIH is center of the government's gigantic medical research efforts. In terms of nutrition research, however, something is amiss. None of these 27 institutes and centers at the NIH is devoted to nutrition. Despite the pivotal nature of nutrition in health, and despite the public interest in the subject. One of the arguments against having a separate institute for nutrition is that the existing institutes already concern themselves with nutrition. But this does not happen. Chart 16.3 shows the funding priorities for various health topics at the NIH. Of the $30.55 billion NIH budget for 2015, only about 5% is designated for projects that are related in some way to nutrition, and 23% for projects that are related to prevention. That may not sound too bad, but these figures are seriously misleading. Most of the prevention and nutrition budgets have absolutely nothing to do with prevention and nutrition, as I have written in this book. We won't be hearing about exciting research on dietary patterns, nor will there be serious efforts to tell the public how diet affects health. Instead, the prevention and nutrition budgets will be designated for developing drugs and nutrient supplements. Several years ago, the director of the NCI, the oldest of the NIH institutes, described prevention as efforts to directly prevent and or inhibit malignant transformation, to identify, characterize, and manipulate factors that might be effective in achieving that inhibition and attempts to promote preventative measures. This so-called prevention is all about manipulation of isolated chemicals. To identify, characterize, and manipulate factors is a not-so-secret code for drug discovery. Considered from another perspective, the The NCI of the NIH in 1999 had a budget of $2.93 billion. In a major five-a-day dietary program, it was spending $500,000 to $1 million to educate the public to consume five or more servings of fruits and vegetables per day. This is only 0.03%, 0.0256% of its budget. That's $2.56 for every $10,000. If it calls this a major campaign, I pity its minor campaigns. The NCI also has been funding a couple of multi-year large studies, including the Nurses' Health Study at Harvard, discussed in Chapter 14, and the Women's Health Initiative, which is mostly devoted to the testing of hormone replacement therapy, vitamin D and calcium supplementation, and the effect of a moderately low-fat diet on prevention of breast and colon cancer. These rare nutrition-related studies unfortunately suffer from the same experimental flaws described in Chapter 14. Almost always, these studies are designed to tinker with one nutrient at a time, among an experimental population that uniformly consumes a high-risk animal-based diet. These studies have a very high probability of creating some very unnecessary, and very expensive, confusion. If very few of our tax dollars are used to fund nutrition research, what do they fund? Almost all of the billions of dollars of taxpayer money the NIH spends annually funds projects to develop drugs, supplements, and mechanical devices. In essence, the vast bulk of biomedical research funded by you and me is basic research to discover products that the pharmaceutical industry can develop and market. In 2000, Dr. Marcia Angel, a former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, summarized it well when she wrote, "The pharmaceutical industry enjoys extraordinary government protections and subsidies. Much of the early basic research that may lead to drug development is funded by the National Institutes of Health. It is usually only later, when the research shows practical promise, that the drug companies become involved. The industry also enjoys great tax advantages. Not only are its research and development costs deductible, but so are its massive marketing expenses. The average tax rate of major U.S. industries from 1993 to 1996 was 27.3% of revenues. During the same period, the pharmaceutical industry was reportedly taxed at a rate of only 16.2%. Most important, the drug companies enjoyed 17-year government-granted monopolies on their new drugs, that is, patent protection. Once a drug is patented, no one else may sell it, and the drug company is free to charge whatever the traffic will bear. Our tax dollars are used to make the pharmaceutical industry more profitable. One could argue that this is justified by gains in public health, but the alarming fact is that this tide of money into drugs, genes, devices, and technology research will never cure our chronic diseases. Our chronic diseases are largely the result of infinitely complex assaults on our bodies resulting from eating bad food. No single chemical intervention will ever equal the power of consuming the healthiest food. In addition, isolated chemicals in drug form can be very dangerous. The National Cancer Institute itself states, "What is clear is that most of our current treatments will produce some measure of adversity." There is no danger to eating a healthy diet, and there are far more benefits, including massive cost savings both on the front end of preventing disease and on the back end of treating disease. So why is our government ignoring the abundant scientific research supporting a dietary approach in favor of largely ineffective, potentially dangerous drug and device interventions? Personal accounts. In terms of public nutrition policy, I want to leave you with one short story that says so much about the government's priorities. One of my former graduate students at Cornell, Dr. Antonia Dimas, did her doctoral research in education by teaching a healthy food and nutrition-based curriculum to elementary school kids and then integrating those healthy foods into the school lunch program. She had been doing this work as a volunteer mother in her children's schools for 17 years prior to her graduate studies. I was her advisor for the nutrition part of her dissertation research. The U.S. Department of Agriculture administers the school lunch program to 29.5 million children, largely relying on an inventory of government-subsidized foods. The government program, as it now stands, uses mostly animal-based products and even requires that participating schools make available cow's milk. At the local level, this usually means that consumption of milk is mandatory. Dr. Dimas's innovative research on the school lunch program was a great success. Children loved the learning style and were excited to eat the healthy foods when they went through the lunch line. The children then convinced their parents to eat the healthy food at home. Dr. Dimas's program won national awards for the most creative implementation of the dietary guidelines and excellence in nutrition education. The program proved to be of interest to more than 300 school lunch and behavioral rehabilitation programs around the U.S., including schools in areas as widely dispersed as Hawaii, Florida, Indiana, New England, California, and New Mexico. In this effort, Dr. Dimas has organized a nonprofit foundation, Food Studies Institute, Trumansburg, New York, and written a curriculum, Food is Elementary. And here's the kicker. Dr. Dimas's program is entirely plant-based. I had the opportunity to go to Washington and talk with Dr. Eileen Kennedy, who was then the director of the Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion at the USDA. Dr. Kennedy was deeply involved both in the school lunch program and the Dietary Guidelines Committee, on which it was revealed that she had ties to the dairy industry. The topic of our discussion was Dr. Dimas's innovative school lunch program and how it was garnering national attention. At the end of this discussion, I said to her, "You know, that program is entirely plant-based." She looked at me, wagged her finger as if I were being a bad boy, and said, "We can't have that." Here's an even more recent story. After publication of the first edition of this book in 2005, I was afforded the opportunity to call on some of my political and government friends who were expressing interest in the book's contents. On a couple of my visits to Washington, I invited my colleague, Dr. Caldwell Esselstein, to join me. Together, we talked with some senior officials, especially at the USDA, about our views and books. We received courteous, warm receptions by government administrators of food and health programs. At the time, I was tentatively hopeful of our making some progress, because I once thought that getting support from government program leaders would be an effective way to inform the public. I mostly learned that I was wrong. Nothing came of all those visits. To give one example, we met 5 of the 6 top USDA administrators, a couple of whom I had had prior personal acquaintance with, and who were familiar with my interests and my work in days gone by, when I was less problematic. Although, as professionals, they acknowledged our achievements without question, it also quickly became clear to me that they were merely being courteous in meeting with us. These program leaders do not have to stand for elections, but they still answer to superiors who do. And we now know how elections are won, especially since the Citizens United case was decided by the Supreme Court in a way that gave much more power to the corporate sector. That is, elected officials and their subordinates are now even more subservient to corporate interests. It is also worth mentioning the 2015 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, which generated a lot of controversy and news. This is the scientific advisory group that writes the scientific report of the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, which should form the basis of the final dietary guidelines. In 2015, in the executive summary of their report, the scientific panel stated, The overall body of evidence examined by the 2015 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee identifies that a healthy dietary pattern is higher in vegetables, fruits, whole grains, low or non-fat dairy, seafood, legumes, and nuts, moderate in alcohol among adults, lower in red and processed meat, and low in sugar-sweetened foods and drinks and refined grains. They also considered environmental sustainability, given the importance of food choices in our environment. The major findings regarding sustainable diets were that a diet higher in plant-based foods, such as vegetables, fruits, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds, and lower in calories and animal-based foods, is more health-promoting and is associated with less environmental impact than is the current U.S. diet. Despite not embracing a whole foods, plant-based diet, these exceptionally conservative, easily justified statements certainly are more progressive than the government reports we discussed in the first part of this chapter, written for the first edition. The 2015 scientific report met with tremendous resistance, unsurprisingly. Detractors claim that environmental sustainability is not relevant to guidelines on food and nutrition, an odd complaint, seeing as no one seemed to have a problem with including physical activity guidance and commentary, a completely non-food issue, as part of the nutrition guidelines. But the idea that got these critics riled was that the government might recommend eating less red and processed meat in favor of plants. 30 senators, all Republican, drafted a letter critical of the scientific report. They wrote, "Not only do we represent farmers and ranchers who raise animals to provide healthy meat products, but we also represent consumers who enjoy lean meat as an important food in their diet. The inconsistencies brought forward in the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee's report are significant. We encourage you to carefully consider the most relevant nutrition scientific literature and reject the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee's inconsistent conclusions regarding the role of meat in Americans' diets as you finalize the dietary guidelines." 71 representatives in the House, all of whom were Republican, signed a similarly critical letter as well. They wrote, "The Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee's recommendation on lean red meat directly contradicts years of peer-reviewed scientific research on the benefits of lean red meat as a high-quality source of protein in a healthy diet." What's going on here? I never knew we had such a well-versed cadre of nutrition science enthusiasts among our elected officials. Could major portions of the Senate and House of Representatives have been quietly reading abundant primary research on nutrition and health? And could the scientific body fail to have considered some large body of nutrition research that these apparent nutrition enthusiasts read in their spare time? Or is it something else? One analysis showed that the senators had received over $1 million from the food industry in the previous year, about half of which was from the beef industry. The House signers received at least $2 million from food and agricultural interests during the previous year. In our opinion, their agendas could not be more plain. Of course, in the end, the scientists were only advisors. Never a group to let scientists dictate scientific recommendations, government administrators formulating the final report gutted the executive summary in a blatant effort to bury any anti-industry themes. Any anti-animal food sentiment was replaced or eliminated. When discussing what people might consider cutting back on, they focused on nutrients and not foods, a common tactic to make recommendations harder to understand. After the administrators were done, the main guidelines, as stated in the executive summary, were 1. Follow a healthy eating pattern across the lifespan. 2. Focus on variety, nutrient density, and amount. Choose a variety of nutrient-dense foods across and within all food groups. 3. limit calories from added sugars and saturated fats, and reduce sodium intake. 4. Shift to healthier food and beverage choices. Choose nutrient-dense foods and beverages across and within all food groups in place of less healthy choices. Consider cultural personal preferences to make these shifts easier to accomplish and maintain. 5. Support healthy eating patterns for all. What meaningless drivel! Industry couldn't have written the executive summary any differently if they themselves had drafted it. Only the sugar industry remained targeted. The focus on sugar, in some ways, has been a more politically palatable, even welcome distraction from the evidence against red meat and milk. During the 2015 guidelines battle, the House of Representatives wrote a section of a bill to appropriate $1 million to fund a formal review of how the dietary guidelines are drafted. They wanted to ensure that there are broad viewpoints among panel members, and that they follow rigid scientific standards, whose, I wonder, to make recommendations. I can only interpret this to mean that those friendly to industry wanted to take steps to fundamentally change the guidelines process, so industry never again has to publicly deny science and flex their political muscle. The whole episode could not have been good PR. It is much better for industry and elected officials if industry can pull the strings of government outside public view. I have concluded that when it comes to health, government is not for the people. It is for the food industry and the pharmaceutical industry at the expense of the people. It is a systemic problem where industry, academia, and government combine to determine the health of this country. Industry funds public health reports, and academic leaders with industry ties play key roles in developing them. A revolving door exists between government jobs and industry jobs, and government research funding goes to develop drugs and devices instead of healthy nutrition. It is a system built by people who play their isolated parts, often unaware of the top decision makers and their ulterior motivations. In the rare cases when this system doesn't work, industry can rely on elected officials to directly intervene in any recommendations or determinations that do not favor their bottom line. The system is a waste of taxpayer money and is profoundly damaging to our health. Chapter 17. Big Medicine. Whose health are they protecting? When was the last time you went to the doctor and he or she told you what to eat or what not to eat? You probably never had that experience. But the vast majority of Americans will fall prey to one of the chronic diseases of affluence discussed in Part 2. And, as you have seen, there is a wealth of published research that suggests these diseases are a result of poor nutrition, not poor genes or bad luck. So why doesn't the medical system take nutrition seriously? 4 words: money, ego, power, and control. While it is unfair to generalize about individual doctors, it is safe to say that the system they work in, the system that currently takes responsibility for promoting the health of Americans, is failing us. No one knows this better than the tiny minority of doctors who treat their patients from a nutritional perspective. 2 of the most prominent doctors in this minority have spent many years emphasizing diet and health, both in public, within their profession, and in private with their patients. They have had exceptionally impressive results protecting their patients' health. These 2 doctors are Caldwell B. Esselstein, Jr., whose work we discussed in Chapter 5, and John McDougall, an internist. My son Tom and I sat down with these men to discuss their experience advocating a Whole Foods plant-based WFPB diet in the medical setting. Dr. Sprouts. Long before our country was founded, Dutch pioneers had settled in the Hudson Valley north of New York City. One of these settler families were the Esselsteins. they started farming a plot of land in 1675. 9 generations later, that farm still belongs to the Esselstein family. Dr. Esselstein and his wife Anne own the several hundred acre Hudson Valley farm.